I think a large part of, you know, like successfully solving these problems is aligning interests, right? How do we make sure our partners have the same interests as Overstock, as our customers?
You're listening to Data Science Leaders from Domino Data Lab, a podcast for data science teams tackling the world's most important challenges. Each episode features an interview with a leader in data science. We'll discuss how to build and enable teams, create scalable processes, collaborate cross-functionally, communicate with business stakeholders, and more. Let's get into the show.
Welcome to the DSL podcast. So before we get going, you are based in Salt Lake City, Utah, correct?
Yeah, I am.
Yeah. All right. So
proud resident of Utah.
Proud resident of Utah. So folks I know who live in Utah are also great skiers. I imagine you're a great skier as well. Is that correct?
Talk to me in 5 years and maybe I'll get there. For now, I'm just learning. I just started getting on the blues and the blacks this season, and it's been so much fun.
It is a blast. You know, be safe out there, but you know, I started my skiing journey about 20 years ago, and it's been a lot of fun. I mean, it's an expensive hobby, but it is a lot of fun as well. So, you know, it's beautiful, it's gorgeous, but you also got to be safe. And I never skied in Utah, but I hope to at one point.
You are missing out, my friend.
I know. I have to slum it in Lake Tahoe. I kid.
Definitely all right. Come by at some point.
I will try. All right. So Nishan here is the VP of algorithms at Overstock. He's 7 years into his career and has clearly shot up the ladder, which we'll talk about in a bit here, which I find, you know, very interesting, and reached the VP rank. So before we get going, we get a lot of titles here, you know, in the DSL podcast, you know, chief data scientist, VP of analytics, and more. But VP of algorithms, I've seen, you know, the algorithm sort of title. What does VP of algorithms mean to you when compared to your other DSL colleagues?
Yeah. So, I guess the two I'll contrast with is like, one is the chief data scientist title, and then, you know, maybe more of the analytics heavy titles. So to me, like a VP title as opposed to like chief data scientist means you're an organizational leader, right? So your function is not just kind of application of science, but the management of the team and the people that apply the science. And the contrast with analytics is like, I think of what we do as building algorithmic products. So really like, driving business innovation, or like changing the business, changing how we do business by building new capabilities. So it's very product oriented that way. You know, we're not just kind of doing analysis to inform decisions, but hopefully to put products out there that inform decisions. And that I think is a pretty important kind of nuance. So I kind of self-identify, I guess, with my title quite a bit in that it being an organizational role. And needing to put a emphasis and care on the organizational side of things as well. And also like we need to launch products and, you know, we need to kind of get things out there. So it's more than analytics in that regard.
And that is the topic of today's podcast, is really operationalizing data science and building sort of machine learning, you know, data science type products. So we'll definitely dive into that throughout the conversation today. So it's been in 7 years, you shot up to being this VP of algorithms at Overstock. One of the things that I've also noted so far is a lot of our DSL colleagues happen to have a PhD, and you do not. So my question is, when are you getting your PhD? Because clearly you're inadequate.
Yeah, as soon as possible. You know, I've been meaning to do it. It's just this job gets in the way.
Right. This job thing. But my guess, do you have plans of eventually getting a PhD, going back to school at all, or no?
You know, that's, I don't know. It's something I've contemplated for a while. And I probably won't end up getting a PhD until maybe after I retire. I do want to get a PhD in a completely different topic at some point in time, something around philosophy. But till then,
that's another podcast altogether. But we're going to try to stay on topic. I'd love to dive into your philosophical leanings, but
No, but till then, I don't think so. And I think it's to me, the biggest value of not having a PhD is kind of is how humble it keeps me, and not humble bragging by any means, you know, but like more than I guess half of my organization has PhDs. And so like these folks are like experts in their respective domains, right? And so they come in with a lot of knowledge. And so it helps me approach like every conversation with humility and learning, where I'm like, they certainly know a lot more than me in regards to these specific things. And so I think that helps me become a better listener, because one thing I found is like listening is a really important skill for leadership. And it's probably one of the most hardest things to do. So, you know, and the other thing is like everything is super fascinating and interesting to me, like every research body. So it allows me to do these dives into bodies of research that I had no idea about. And I have all my colleagues to help me in that journey. So like not having a PhD has paid off really well for me so far.
Yeah. Well, that's a very healthy, I think, point of view, right? Is to see yourself as, you mean, even as a leader, you don't have to be the smartest person in the room all the time, right? Like, you don't have to be the expert in every single area. I mean, you can't, given the breadth of data science. It's, I mean, not say you can't, but it's very difficult, right? To see your team as like this collection of experts is certainly interesting. So I applaud you with your healthy outlook on managing. I think that's a great way to look at it. And I'm sure it, you know, engenders you to your team. I'm sure they appreciate, you know, your listening and your style, right? So I think that's fantastic.
Yeah, I think the first thing that it kind of gets to is like, you know, there's no tension, right? Like, I think the titles, well, I'd like to think the titles kind of disappear. And so like when I come to them as experts and kind of just like, I'm trying to learn, they get a lot more comfortable. They think more and, you know, they're more open to expressing more of the out there ideas. And then we have something really interesting to work with at that point in time. And the other thing is like, I think for me, like, it's not just me, right? There's like experts in all these other domains, but I think they could be learning from each other as well. So that is like a really big emphasis I put in terms of how the organization is structured. Like, learning is front and central to the function of the organization, right? And so we have a bunch of things going that foster that culture.
Yeah. Let's start diving into how your team is organized. I do want to get into you seeing sort of the work that you're doing being embedded as a product. We will absolutely get there, but this is a fascinating topic. So what, when you say like in their areas of expertise, what areas do you have sort of experts in that really help out overstock in your team?
So, yeah, I guess it might be good to give a very brief introduction, right? Like Overstock is a e-commerce platform. We're a retail store. So we handle kind of all parts of the retail chain, from operations and logistics, you know, delivery to the marketplace itself, right? And then discovery on the marketplace. So and as the algorithms unit, like all of these business problems, like the algorithmic side of these problems come to my organization. Mostly we focus on like search and recommendations, like around discovery, helping users find what they're looking for really, right? And then other parts of the business around marketing, like focusing on marketing challenges, like how much do you spend? What kinds of targeting do you do? To supply chain forecasts in terms of like delivery estimates, shipping costs, you know? So it's a wide variety of problems that way. And the way we've grown the organization is like, try to find experts in respective domains, respective parts of, you know, these problems. So around search, we have like people focused on NLP. We have a lot of image modeling expertise. We have traditional IR research expertise, you know, and so those are some major ones. And then around operational OR, right? Operation research and kind of that's an evolving field as well. We have like quite a few like people leaning on statistical expertise as well. So and various schools have various ways they approach it. And also like a new role I'm really excited that we have in the organization now is that of an experimentation scientist. And our newest member to the organization, like she has a econometric background and game theory background. So we do a lot of like, we have a sponsor product platform that we maintain in-house as well. So we deal with a lot of economic factors in that as well. So, you know, econometrics and game theory and like mechanism design and choice theory and all of these kind of our expertise that we like to foster.
And what is the goal of the experimentation scientist? Is it sort of like more R&D focused?
It's uplifting our experimentation practices and understanding of how we conduct experiments.
Got it. So like design of experiments type.
Yeah, design of experiments. Yeah. So it could be like randomized controlled trials, right? Like A/B tests that we run on the site. But also like there's, I think, more interesting like counterfactual questions we could be asking. So like by and large, actually causal theory is another thing that we're probably going to lean more towards in the future. But basically saying like, you know, our statistics, our numbers describe the way things are today, right? So if you abstract away from that model, then you can kind of from that reality in terms of numbers to a model that describes the reality, then you can say, what would happen if things were a different way? And it's, I think the counterfactual and causality like research is doing some really good work in these directions. And so being able to ask these counterfactual questions, and these are applicable in all sorts of different ways, right? Like, so one example is, what would happen if you were to not show sponsored results? Is one form you can ask the question. And also ask, what would happen if you, you know, like didn't send out a coupon or didn't spend this much on this advertising channel, or like, you know, you made this decision as opposed to that decision. Now, these questions have existed for a very long time, but I think these approaches, like causal relationship, being able to capture those allows us to answer those questions a whole lot better. So I think, you know, it has the potential to give us a lot more meaningful approach to data-driven decision-making in the company.
That is very, very cool. I can imagine you must have a close partnership with the folks on the business side, because a lot of those questions, I'm sure they'd be dying to know the answers to. So, I mean, is that the case?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, as an executive, you know, it's like we're as a general body, like trying our best to come up with the right answers to these questions, right? And a lot of, you know, the strategy questions, I think, can be a lot better answered with better data and the right modeling of the business domain, of the business challenges, I think is essential to be able to come up with the right kind of answers there. So, is, you know, you solve this problem, it's applicable to any business in any industry, really.
That's great. So it sounds like, you know, in your role as a VP of algorithms, you're not just, and we'll talk about this again in a sec, you're not just talking about embedding some of the, you know, the models into, you know, production-like settings into your, you know, Overstock's publicly facing site, but also you're also involved in some of the strategy conversations as well. So trying to understand, you know, what would happen if, you know, we didn't spend as much on this campaign or that campaign and that kind of thing. Sort of some bit of sort of what if analysis. That's fantastic. So let's dive into the sort of the core topic of the show. I think a lot of DSLs out there are very curious about on the topic of just productionalizing models in general and really embedding them into, you know, customer facing or user facing sort of places, right? Talk to us. I mean, search is obviously a big area. When you look at your career, it's been a big focus. Talk to us just a bit. First of all, I'll just dumb it down for people like myself on what it is that you do to improve search and what does a day-to-day look like from your perspective?
So I guess, you know, as of, I mean, honestly, maybe 10 or more years ago, but like various industries have seen transformation in different times. Like, search used to be mostly driven by like information retrieval. It was all about like what information is in the document and then how do you like surface that, right? I think a lot of the evolution with machine learning on search has come to, well, what is the user looking for? And different users might be looking for different things. And in e-commerce, that gets further complicated with like, well, the user might want to look at something, you know, but they might want to buy something that's a little different from the things they enjoy just looking at. And like, what are those differences and how do you model those challenges? So that kind of broadly sets the context for the search problem that we look at. Also, I think
let me try to put it in my own words. So you're saying you know, sort of search started with just looking at the, you know, the keywords that were typed in and making sure that you, that what was retrieved in the search results sort of matched logically the words that were found. But,
yeah.
But truly what search is all about is understanding, you know, what is the user, person who's searching, actually looking for. The words that they put in might not be exactly the right words.
Exactly right.
Yeah. So that's a great way of looking at it for sure. I can see that being a much more difficult challenge.
Yeah, we kind of look at it as like, you know, moving from like search for X, get X, really, right? It is how it's laid out. But then search with the intent of X and get X is, you know, where we're evolving towards. And different people might have different intents, and being able to capture that, all the nuances of it, and being able to serve every customer, you know, whether it's collecting everything that everyone might want into this one experience and showing it to everyone, or knowing better what you personally want and showing you those things.
Right.
Those are the kind of trade-offs and challenges we work through in terms of search. So a lot of the work we do on search is getting closer and evolving more towards these kinds of like being able to truly capture the intent of what the customer is looking for, right? That's where we're going. Then it also gets kind of blurred with recommendations. Cause like, so a lot of times like recommendations are discovery oriented, right? Like it's, you've done some things with us in the past, or like, you know, this is what we think you might like, and those get surfaced. But then the only distinction I think there's a conscious action with a search, and perhaps with a recommendation, there is at least, you know, on the surface, there's no specific action that the user is undertaking. But then that also gets kind of blurry, right? Because they do scroll, you know, to look at recommendations. If you're showing good recommendations, they're probably scrolling through your site. So I think, you know, the journey we're on in this sense is like, how do we give them what they're looking for with less and less friction, right? How do we give the customers without them needing to really do, like maybe it was typing the exact magic keyword to get the products you're looking for. But then like this has really hit home for me at Overstock, because like oftentimes I don't know the name of what things are called, right? Like, what's an ottoman, you know? Like, am I looking for a bookshelf? Am I looking? And so those lines get super blurry. And as a customer coming into the platform, like, I have no idea what to call the thing I'm looking for, right? Yeah. So either I can look at the structures that exist, which is navigation, right? Like, I look at the structures, like how people have organized things, and maybe try to find my way there. Or I just type whatever comes to my mind, and I've started my journey into discovering what I'm looking for. So I think, you know, it's like the search and recommendations, like the discovery problem is evolving, and we're just at the start. And I think we're going to end up with really interesting experiences that give you what you're looking for with a lot less friction, and help you find things that you didn't even know you were looking for, but happen to suit your needs fairly well.
Right. So basically reading the mind of the person who's searching is really the goal. So speaking of which, how do you improve upon this search? To improve upon it, you have to, you know, there has to be some sort of yardstick, some metric that you're looking to measure. So how does that process work?
Absolutely. So we have like, broadly classifying online and offline metrics, right? Online metrics is like what the users did, and offline metrics are what we use to inform our models and train our models on. And, you know, there's like very standard metrics out there. Like NDCG is something that's very standardized. It's normalized discounted cumulative gain, essentially saying, if you know what kind of, you know, things are rewarded, which you usually end up getting either by human labels or by looking at what users have done in the past. So once you have that label, you know, how do you rank the things that are rewarded, right? Once you define a reward, and it's normalized discounted because it's like bounded between 0 and 1, but that's standard in terms of metric calculation. But what it means to be rewarded, that varies different across different systems and kind of challenges. So that's the offline ones. And then there's online metrics, like your standard ones you'd expect, like click-through rate. And for e-commerce, there's conversion. Like adding to cart could be something that's meaningful as well.
Right.
But then once you have like, you know, some solution, you want to go deeper into solving some specific problem, there might be other like interesting challenges as well. So like, how long did the user stay on the platform? Or, you know, were we effective at getting people to the next stage of the funnel, which is if you're on a search page and you found something, you probably want to learn more about that product. So you'd go to like the product description page. It's a, that can be right. an online metric you track as well. And, or like how frustrated, like the frustration of the user can be a different a metric you capture as well. So like how many times did the user search for something very similar? That means right. they're probably not finding what they're looking for. And so, yeah, there's plenty of metrics.
I mean, in my experience, like time on site, as an example, can be kind of a confusing one. I'm not confusing, exactly. but it can be a tricky one because time on site, if a user's on the site for a long period of time, it could be just because they're having trouble finding the product, exactly. which could be a bad thing. Exactly. On the other hand, if they're on the site for a long period of time and they're buying things, you know, all along the way, you know, and finding what they need, then that's a fantastic experience. So like you can't, you know, you have to sort of mix, I imagine, that time on site with some other metrics in order to understand whether or not they're actually having a good experience and a good right. outcome. Right. And then there's good outcomes for the buyer, the user, and there's good outcomes for Overstock too, right? And you also have to mix that in.
Yeah, well, that's actually really interesting because like, I think a large part of, you know, like successfully solving these problems is aligning interests, right? How do we make sure our partners have the same interests as Overstock as our customers are having? And I strongly believe in it comes down to the customer. If you're serving yeah. your customer well, right? Like you'll have a good business and you'll have good partners that work with you. And like the things I find super fascinating, especially with some of the, you know, like the marketing products that we build, like the auctions, is how do we align everything towards the user's intent and serve that better?
Yeah. Yep. All about the user. Like if you service their needs and keep them and at the top of the list, you know, their lifetime value will only increase. Right. Well, that's so talk a little bit about talk a little bit about how you actually, you know, roll out changes, let's say, to search yep. on a regular basis. So yep. Can you talk through a little bit about the process of that? I think people are, yep. you know, very interested in taking the workbench, you know, data science, some of the work, the experimentation work, right. and then the process of getting that into production. Is that, does your team own that? Do you partner with, you know, maybe folks on the, you know, the IT side who might be, mm-hmm. you know, own the site? Tell us more about that.
So I think, you know, take a minute to talk about the process of science, I guess, right? And machine learning is like to discover anything worthwhile, like the scientist takes a particular thing, puts it in a workbench. It's going to be in a very physical form, right? Like, and then very carefully teases out signal from noise to get to a point where they're like, okay, with all of these right parameters, with this very specific, precise ways to do things, I think I've discovered something useful. I've discovered something that adds value, right? Now right. there's this whole challenge of having discovered that, how do you, in its like pure pristine form, the all the correct parameters, how do you get that into a production context? And if you have to involve a lot of people in that process, there's lots of chances for miscommunication and error, right? It's like right. the productionizing engineer didn't realize how important it was to preserve all of these metrics, or like, you know, like all of a sudden, like your data started changing and they didn't realize that it was really important that like that the data preserve its form. And so lots of those things can happen. So the way like we've approached this is like empower the teams specifically to own the end-to-end problem, right? So let's say ranking is an example. So for search, we two primary teams that build our search systems are like core search and then ranking. So core search handles the candidate set selection problem and lots of the systematic challenges. And then ranking is responsible for the re-ranking problem. So given a set of products, how do I best align them for the customer? Right? That's at least the current way we have it set up. But then each of these teams, they're owning like individual systems that they deploy, they manage, they look at dashboards for, right? So they're responsible for the, not just the discovery, like the problem formulation, the work, the development, the science on it, as well as the production and maintenance of it. So it's very similar to, you know, like DevOps as a mindset and further extension of it to the machine learning space.
This is gold right here, Nishan. One thing that I've seen, right, is that it is not uncommon that you have a data science team doing sort of data science sort of workbench work, mm-hmm. and then they pass it off to say an ML engineer, or right. I think you called it a productionization engineer.
Just made that up.
That might be on a separate team altogether, right? And they even will take the model, potentially rewrite it, and make sure that it can work in their downstream production system. In this case, it would be your .com site. You're saying no. The teams at Overstock are aligned sort of by product. In this case, it could be your re-ranking, the search ranking team. And that includes the sort of ML engineer along with the data scientists. I mean, do you all talk a little bit about what those teams look like?
Yeah. So like I said before, right? Like we're really responsible for algorithmic products. And so we are kind of structured from a product perspective that way. But like algorithms is the center of excellence for machine learning and AI, because that's really important too, right? Like at our size, you know, we're probably like 5% of the company in terms of total number of people focusing on a problem. And I think it's really important for us to preserve like that excellence and foster a culture where people learn from one another and grow, right? Like as we talked about like 10 minutes ago, it's that culture is super important, but then we still need a product orientation. So, so we spend a lot of time in the way we design these teams end up having a lot to do with like the product orientation, like what is the right product that this team can own and maintain. And those boundaries do evolve over time. But then once we do that, like we make sure like they're self-sufficient. So what kind of skill sets does a team need for it to be able to, you know, take it all the way home? And so we have like machine learning teams that whose core focus is machine learning, but then also have, you know, like people that are maybe growing towards that journey, right? Or handling more of the engineering sides of machine learning. So like broad classification wise, like we have machine learning scientists and engineers, and they're all kind of part of the team. And there's no defined thing saying a scientist does this, an engineer does that. We kind of just take more, like, you know, when we kind of figure out who's working on what, it's like, well, more of the engineer person, it makes sense for more of the engineer to take on this problem because it's more engineering heavy, but they still own it from like, well, there's some science involved with it. So they need to make sure they work with this person either as a mentor or they're like collaborating on it, whatever structure makes sense at that point in time. But that ownership may exist, and the lines of like, you know, what's engineering and what's science, that's blurry, right? And also like even like folks that have DevOps kind of roles, like they train models as well. I think that's super important. So like
that's interesting.
And people evolve and they change, right? Like we have folks that, you know, started out as analysts, and we've seen them go both into the scientist track and the engineer track, right? Based on the interests. And these interests evolve over time as they discover more of like what they enjoy doing and what they're good at and what they're not. And I think that's a journey everyone goes through. But then the organization structure, I think, needs to be able to support these kinds of journeys and discoveries while ensuring quality in terms of the product we deliver. And so for that, you know, like, so on a high level, right, like maintain a center of excellence around our field, or, you know, like North Star, which is the research that comes out in this industry. And then, or a thing that may be applicable to the industry that's vaguely related, right? Like make sure there is enough interest and enough of collaboration and an environment where people can actually like take the time to study on research, but then set it up in terms of ways where people are accountable for the end-to-end delivery of whatever problem they're working on. So that allows them to be more engaged in the problem, understand the domain better, and feel empowered. Because it's really gratifying to, you know, productionize something and see users interact with it, right? So that's at the core of, you know,
And measure the results, right?
And measure the results.
I mean, for each of these teams, do you goal them on a particular metric, like some of the metrics that we were talking about before? Is that something that, you know, they have a dashboard that you know, you're looking at and reviewing with them on a regular basis?
Yeah, absolutely. And I wouldn't review them with them on a basis that way, but they're expected to have one. They're expected to know what their KPIs are, and they're expected to define each problem. Like, they're expected to translate each problem they're solving into a KPI that's measurable.
Perfect.
And, you know, that's either like a primary KPI or a secondary KPI, right? And that is business and user focused. And so, like I talked about offline metrics and online metrics, and, you know, a lot of the times the science happens with the offline metrics, but the accountability on the team or the scientist level is still for the production, like KPI. So they're being measured on business outcomes that way. And, you know, I think that helps shape a lot of the thinking towards what's good for the customer. What can I do that is actually going to have a significant effect, right? And lots of times, like, I think we run into the problem of trying to apply fancy methods for the sake of fanciness. Mm-hmm. And I found this, you know, like, shift towards ownership as the way you look at your work. And so one of our principles, and we borrowed this from Airbnb, is like owning your impact, right? So by owning your impact, you no longer focus on the what model or like what you're doing. It's all of those are means to the end, and the end is affecting the business outcomes. And so I think that allows, you know, our scientists to understand the space and the environment they operate in, the business, a whole lot better. And I think ultimately leads to much better engagement as well.
Yeah. I mean, the imagine again, you have business sponsors on your side. There's a budget that you have, and being able to justify that budget by having sort of metrics that can be understood by your business counterparts is critical, and making sure that your data science team is speaking that same language, mm-hmm. right? You know, that's how it's easy to sort of justify your existence and your growth as a team. You mentioned that, and this makes total sense, that there's sort of blurred lines between the ML engineering sort of track and the ML scientist track, but there has to be some difference in your mindset, that at least at a broad brush strokes, right? In terms of their focus, how would you sort of describe the high level difference between the two roles?
Yeah. I think on a high level, like the scientist is expected to come up with a reasonable model to, you know, that fits the business problem well, right? And the engineer is responsible for the right systems that build, that solve the business problem well. And, you know, so it is very vague and different, but like, so as an example, if a machine learning scientist is trying to learn some engineering, you know, like they probably want to design the overall architecture of how these systems run, right? They'll probably take guidance from some engineer, and vice versa. If an engineer is kind of working on a specific modeling problem, they'll probably be getting guidance from a scientist. But then if a scientist is working on a science problem, like, they're expected to kind of define what the right modeling approach is and justify why they came up with these particular approaches and the right kind of model structures and, you know, and even the metric selection, right? Like, why did you pick this particular metric to solve this problem? Mm-hmm. And then there's a whole bunch of assumptions and stuff that go into it. And so, you know, that's probably the major delineation in terms of the roles.
Got it. That makes perfect sense. So the ML engineer is someone who clearly helps to productionize the model, but also can probably help out with training in terms of, you know, getting the data to the ML scientist, who's a bit more focused on sort of the experimentation of trying different modeling algorithms to, you know, to try to optimize for whatever KPI that team is working on. One quick question. Do you have like a product? So there's those two roles, but then is there any other roles within these product teams? Like, do you have like a product manager or anything like that?
We do. And it was like, you know, it was something like I was very set on from the get-go. And like the best product managers I've worked with, like, they didn't really want to be product managers, you know, but they somehow like,
why do you say that? Like,
well, like a few come to mind, like, so our, like the algorithms product managers usually have an analytics background,
right?
They used to be kind of analysts solving certain functions, but these, like the good ones, like they can speak really well, right? They can distill, like by speak, I mean, like they can distill you know, the conversation, the kind of challenges that are coming up into a cogent kind of formulation of the problem. They mm-hmm. have the capability to understand complexities of what like scientists and engineers are talking about. And they have an eye towards value, right? They know what's going to provide value. They can look at the numbers. They can, you know, make reasonable decisions and for the business as well as, you know, like have a good understanding of the constraints, technology constraints or, you know, like collaboration or like whatever may exist, right? Like company challenges, financial constraints. And so I think like product managers, good product managers are essential to a machine learning product. But it's a new and growing industry. It's not obvious, you know, how you go about, what are the right skill sets you need to be a good machine learning or algorithms product manager. You can't find that in a book, at least right. now. So I think the way I look at it, like it's been a journey for us to figure out what the right kind of skills is. But again, the same kind of, right? Like you approach it with humility and learning and work with the team to evolve the practices, the kinds of like processes or even the product formulation that you end up with. And they're really like, I found the good product managers, they're really part of the team, right? There's a lot of trust and there is like a natural inclination towards taking on particular tasks, but they can still kind of, you know, the manager and the product manager, I find often end up swapping roles based on like whatever's going on. There might be some certain technical things that just need to get done and the manager needs to focus on that. And so the product manager steps in, or the manager sometimes kind of represents the product manager in certain product meetings as well. And, or so, yeah, I think it's a really necessary role, but it's probably a very misunderstood role. And, you know, a lot of times like product managers learn these kind of concepts in terms of what product management means. And it's very hard to apply that to like machine learning. Cause you know, if a product manager comes with, yeah, I want this product and I want it done, you know, within the sprint, like you'll probably get it, but it's probably going to be so far away from the problem you tried to solve that you might've been better off, you know, like spending a month on the problem. And that's a trade-off. It's not always obvious whether, you know, spending more time will give you a better solution or not, but like there's so much more uncertainty in building machine learning products than there is in building software. So you can't expect the same kind of process to translate to building machine learning products. And so you know, a good product manager there is one that really understands the uncertainty and works with the uncertainty, right? In terms of the communication, the deliverables, and yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of content out there that talks about the differences between sort of data science and your the data science lifecycle and the traditional SDLC, the software development lifecycle. I mean, with software, you have a spec, you have requirements, and you can design it, you know, to spec. And as long as it meets, you know, certain SLAs, it's good, it's done. You can build a model, put it out there, and you know, maybe it's your search ranking algorithm, mm-hmm. and it might be good on day one. On day 50, it starts to be not so good, and then it keeps getting worse, right?
Exactly.
So you have this sort of model decay issue, and there's a different mindset, right, that you need to have, and taking sort of a traditional product manager and just assuming that he or she understands that difference is probably a challenge. So I imagine there's cross training involved, right? To take maybe some of the traditional product manager background and train them sort of on data science, or maybe they have a data science background and you feel that they'd be better suited as sort of that PM, that algorithmic algorithms product manager. Do you find that most of your PMs sort of start from the data science world and move, or do they come from the PM traditional PM world?
Very rarely, I think, at least for the core algorithmic products. But then like we actually have a program right now. So like our group product manager for algorithms, he's driving a training program for the rest of the product managers where, you know, like, so some really cool presentations there where like the more algorithms product managers talk through their products, how they approach problem solving in a language that's maybe more palatable to the rest of product management. So there's that cross training is absolutely essential. But what you've found is like, we still need product manager that's well-versed and well assimilated into the machine learning team to represent that team. So, you know, like kind of going back to saying these are like we own algorithmic products. It's like we have algorithmic products and product managers that own and represent that product, right? They're talking to other product managers, figuring out what the right collaboration is and how that product needs to evolve. But that product mindset exists both internally and externally to the problem that's being handled. And we found that that works best. And I think over time, more product managers are going to get better at understanding what they can ask, you know, the algorithmic teams to build, what's the right problems to come to us for, what's the right level of conversation, right? So oftentimes we find in software, like product managers define, this is the feature I want. But then right. in machine learning, it's not very useful. It's much more useful if the product manager comes with, this is the outcomes I want to affect, yep. right? And like, how do you propose we go through it? And then there's pitfalls both ways, right? Like scientists will, an engineer will over-engineer most of the time, you know? And so there's, but a really good product manager is able to, you know, like make sure they distill what's really important to be part of a product while pulling the team back when they have a tendency to over-engineer. Very similarly, right? In like, so, but the conversation happens with like asking for the right kind of metrics, right kind of approach. So it's just the kinds of conversations that you end up having, I think, look very different in the weeds. But on a high level, I think when you talk about it as a product and customer orientation and stuff, the same kind of notions can apply.
Yeah. Well, this has been absolutely fascinating, Nishan. I mean, I think you've certainly hit upon a strategy that is, you know, makes a lot of sense, certainly to me. And it is a bit different, right? Having more of a product focused strategy when it comes to operationalizing machine learning and with your within your algorithms team and even creating a product manager type role that's embedded within these teams is gold. I mean, it just makes a whole heck of a lot of sense to me. Mm-hmm. But I think, like you said, there's no book on it, but maybe you could write that book.
Well, I think we have some other people that do a much better job than me.
All right. Well, we'll let them write the book and maybe you can write the foreword to the book. How about that?
Oh, I would love that.
All right. Well, it's been great. Have fun on the ski slopes there in Utah. I wish you the best of luck and we'll be signing off here. Until next time, everyone. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave. It's fun conversations.
You've been listening to Data Science Leaders. To ensure that you never miss an episode, subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast player. If you're listening in Apple Podcasts, we'd love for you to give a quick rating of the show. Just tap the number of stars you think the show deserves. Until next time.